Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, October 18, 2018. A new report says South Sudan is one of the most dangerous places for aid workers around the world.
Many are killed in gunfire. Sometimes that can be crossfire where they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Other times they're the victims of small armed groups who have resorted to banditry and maybe attacking an aid vehicle or an aid compound in order to for financial gain.
And Deputy SPLM-IO military spokesman apologizes to free abductees.
On behalf of the movement and on behalf of the SPLM-IO, I apologize to them and to their families. We know that one day when there is peace, we will bring everybody who has done something wrong, in particular, outside the rules and regulation of the SPLM-IO.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. An international research group that focuses on problems of humanitarian assistance says South Sudan is now one of the world's most dangerous countries for aid workers. Humanitarian Outcomes in London says 158 relief staff were killed around the world last year, with most deaths occurring in South Sudan, Afghanistan, Central African Republic, Nigeria, and Somalia. South Sudan accounted for a third of the attacks. Bill Eagle reports from Washington.
The new report says over the past 2 years, 103 aid workers were killed in Africa, including more than 40 in South Sudan. The Norwegian Refugee Council, or NRC, says 100 aid workers have lost their lives since conflict began in the world's newest nation 5 years ago. Nigel Trix is the NRC's regional director for East Africa and Yemen.
Many are killed in gunfire. Sometimes that can be crossfire where they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Other times they're the victims of small armed groups who have resorted to banditry and maybe attacking an aid vehicle or an aid compound in order to for financial gain. Sometimes aid workers get caught up or become unwitting participants in conflict just because they're neutral. They help both sides, and that can cause resentment from one side or another, and they are perhaps more deliberately targeted.
The findings were issued by the Aid Worker Security Database, a project of the group Humanitarian Outcomes in London. The report notes a growing trend in the attacks on aid workers, kidnapping. Abby Stoddard, a partner with Humanitarian Outcomes, says it was first noted a few years ago in Afghanistan. She says the Taliban radical Islamic group would detain and interrogate aid workers, but release them a few days later after negotiations with local authorities.
It definitely has a lot to do with showing that they are boss in that area, with intimidating aid groups that might be working there, including local and national organizations who do a lot of the aid work. But also we have heard of cases of certain payoffs, certain compromises. Maybe they want the project to operate in a slightly different location, or they want slightly different types of aid to be delivered. And these are compromises that are uncomfortable for humanitarians to make, but which sometimes happen.
Stoddard says that in conflicts with international forces, such as in Afghanistan and Syria, the kidnappers often target Western aid workers. They are trying to send a message to the West or to gain a large ransom. In contrast to these conflicts, a spike in kidnappings in South Sudan has focused on aid workers from national organizations. In 2017, armed groups there kidnapped 26 local staff, and so far this year, they snatched 17.
And it's much more of a localized phenomenon. It's national staff. It's about the delivery of aid, and it's a crime of opportunity more often. We're going to seize control of this. We might loot the assets, or we don't want it going to this particular area. So it's a very kind of localized action, and it's not yet, and we hope it won't turn into a sort of a cottage industry for collecting ransoms the way, you know, it could in other places.
Stoddard and Trick say aid workers with national aid groups are more at risk. They are closer to the front lines and often venture into remote and hard-to-reach areas. In response to the threats, humanitarian groups have tightened security. They travel in convoys, avoid traveling at night, work in gated compounds, maintain regular radio communications, and monitor security reports. They often maintain low profiles, removing flags and agency logos from their vehicles, staff, and offices, and sometimes using local taxis to transport goods. Otherwise, Stoddard warns that continued attacks could become normalized, and that could lead relief agencies to pull back staff from rural areas, meaning fewer people are getting needed relief. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says it has reunited dozens of South Sudanese civilians with their families this week after they were released by rebels of the SPLM-IO who abducted them 3 months ago. SPLM-IO deputy military spokesman confirms his group released 40 abductees in Yei. Daniel Friday Martin reports for VOA from Yei Town.
ICRC's communications officer Rike Tova says the abductees were handed over to the ICRC after intense negotiations between the ceasefire and transitional security arrangements monitoring mechanism or citizen officials and rebel leaders in Yei River State.
We were not part of the negotiation. We just helped the release and the transfer of these people from Yei to their families, their home families. We facilitated this release by transferring them from Yei to their homes and families. And hopefully, you know, we get to, you know, the access we need to work. And hopefully, you know, people get what they want. You know, we have talked to people in different parts of the country and they say we want a normal life.
Tova is calling on aid agencies operating in Yei River State to provide the former abductees with food, medicine, and jobs so they can rebuild their lives. Former abductee Justin Baraka says he and other civilians were forced to grow food crops and construct makeshift houses out of grass-thatched roofs and mud and whittle walls. Speaking in Arabic, Baraka says when the abductees were not working, the rebels locked them up.
We were forced to work in crop farms to harvest crops, dig trenches for the rebel soldiers and build houses throughout the day without any food. At night, we were locked inside and were always guarded under gunpoints.
Baraka says he wants to see his abductors prosecuted in a court of law.
My appeal is that if there are people out there, these human rights violators be taken to court so that the answer in court as to why they were engaged in mistreating people.
62-year-old Natalina Tito says she too was mistreated, tortured, and imprisoned for praying for peace and protection while in the hands of the rebels. Speaking in Arabic, Tito urged South Sudan's leaders on all sides to implement the peace deal so the suffering of the South Sudanese people will end. Colonel Lam Paul Gabriel, the SPLA-IO deputy military spokesman who confirmed 40 abductees were freed, says the abductors will be brought to book.
We are very happy that they are all alive. If they have been mistreated, if they have been tortured, on behalf of the movement and on behalf of the SPLA, I apologize to them and to their families. We know that one day when there is peace, we will bring everybody who has done something wrong, in particular, outside the rules and regulations of the SPLA-IO. We'll all bring them to book. So that's why we call for accountability. The accountability does not only call, let me say, it's not only one-sided. It applies to everybody, including the SPLA-IO. So all of us will be accountable for our own actions if they demand for justice.
Lieutenant Colonel Marco Machar, the government military spokesman in Yei River State, welcomes the SPLA-IO's action.
It is a good sign showing that there is commitment. And we in the military, especially in Southern Sudan, People Defense Force, we are bound to protect civilians and the properties. And we need also IO to be bound by peace agreement because we are for cessation of hostilities, of which we don't need anybody to be tortured.
Kemis Benson, a human rights activist in Yei River State, urges all parties to the peace agreement to respect the cessation of hostilities agreement and is calling for the establishment of the hybrid court to charge war criminals.
This is one of the things, one of the ways of according respect for the peace agreement, because the cessation of hostilities agreement calls for release of all prisoners of war. The revitalized peace agreement has also called for this establishment of a hybrid court, reconciliation, justice, and it's about 40 that who are released should be part of the people who will be accorded justice as the implementation process continues.
Chapter 2 of the Revitalized Peace Agreement requires both the government and the armed opposition to release all prisoners of war and political detainees in their custody and hand them over to the ICRC. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin, reporting from Yei Town.
From Yei, we move to Bor, where a court in Jonglei State Capital has sentenced three employees of the French humanitarian agency ACTED to 2 years in prison and fines of 20,000 South Sudanese pounds each. The three South Sudanese local aid workers were charged with stealing relief items and attacking officials of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Bor town. For VOA News, Deng Gai Deng reports from Bor.
Last month, police in the Jonglei state capital Bor arrested seven aid workers employed by the French aid agency ACTED for allegedly stealing relief food meant for vulnerable people. ACTED supervisor Mary Anuel Majuk led a team of employees to discuss the matter with David Allier, the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission coordinator for Bor County last month. Prosecutors say during the discussions, an argument ensued between ACTED employees and the RRC official, and that the ACTED workers physically attacked RRC coordinator Allier. Yesterday, the Bor County Court found three aid workers guilty of attacking Allier and of obstructing work. Defense lawyer Mamer Matuol says the presiding judge did not allow his client to produce their defense witnesses and calls the verdict unfair.
I say this simply because if you want to fast the judgment, you fast the judgment according to the statements of the accused, the complainant, and the witnesses. So if I were the judge, I would have dismissed the case because there was no case here.
Matuol says the fines charged to his client and 2 year sentence are a stipulated number in South Sudanese law.
The fine is 20,000 per each, 20,000 South Sudanese per each, and two years per each in prison. There are three. One lady, Mary Aluel Majuk, Kwai Grand Kwai, and Riak Monchok. Supposed to be 3 months according to the section. Section 121, it says that you would be charged for 3 months and the fine could be 30. So Sudanese pound. 30 pound, not 300. 30 pound, so Sudanese pound.
Matuol says the court has given him 15 days to appeal the ruling. He says since the Jonglei State High Court judge is absent from Bor, he will file his appeal at the High Court in Juba. Lawyer Madine Mayen is the legal advisor for South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Jonglei State. He says the RRC expected a more severe punishment than one delivered, but adds it is satisfied with the court's judgment.
I'm sure that the judge is follow the procedures one by one, and then even they give the defense party, they give the chance to bring the witness, and then they fail to bring it because they want to delay, they want to make the delay tick to delay the case.
David Garangot, chairperson of the Jonglei State Civil Society Network, disagrees.
We are not really contented with the court ruling yesterday. Number two, this is the humanitarian kind of problem which happened between the ACTED and the RRC, and it should be handled based on humanitarian principle. We appeal for the writs of the court ruling. The court ruling did not present the case very well.
Police say investigations into the alleged stealing by ACTED employees of food aid are complete, and a case was filed in Jonglei State High Court, but there is no presiding judge after Justice John Yela Leu left for Juba following the end of his assignment in Jonglei. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what are South Sudanese saying about the September peace deal? Stay tuned for that story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what types of industries produce the most jobs?
Obviously, it's food. Food industry. This do produce more jobs in the sense that you see demand at the market.
I think the business industry right now and the IT industry are producing the most jobs.
Okay, transportation, transport.
Construction, I think construction industry.
Taking what I've observed, education is the industry that has produced jobs, really.
The same thing to the petroleum industries. They also do that. They give job opportunities to all levels, whether educated, non-educated. They will always find a place in those industries.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Residents in South Sudan's Kandak village in Ayot County say they have little hope for peace despite the recently signed revitalized peace agreement. The residents say they will only believe there is peace in South Sudan if they see services like healthcare and education in their area. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Up to 18,000 people, all of them internally displaced persons, live here in Kandak, a remote village located more than 200 miles north of Juba. A majority of the people here fled fighting between government forces and rebels in either Wau or Jonglei State. Many of the IDPs in Kandak say they will only believe peace is restored in the country when they feel secure. They say when social services like health care and schools are back up and running, that is when they will return to their ancestral villages. The IDPs also say they look forward to the day when they produce their own food again. 32-year-old IDP Michael Joboth says he fled Juba in 2016 because he felt insecure and has lived in Kandak ever since then. He says he fears fighting could break out in Kandak anytime as the dry season approaches, claiming government and rebel forces are just a few hundred meters apart.
In this month, there is no fighting around Ayot County. I don't know some places like Bentiu and Malakal. The problem on the fighting on behalf of the water. Now there is dry river water. Now is dry rain season. During dry season, we'll be there in the fighting.
The physically exhausted-looking IDPs in Kandak rely completely on humanitarian assistance for survival. Children beg visitors for anything they see in a visitor's hands. The opposition-controlled area provides no social services, including schools and health clinics. Joboth, a father of three, looks much older than his 32 years. He says he has no way to earn a living to support his family.
We are here in Ayot. There is no organization to run the school. There is CMD, but there is no, has no work. The children are stay going morning. There is no good building. There is no teachers. The teachers have no money. We are staying in the bad condition. There is no drug here in Kandak. Any facility we cannot get.
Under the revitalized peace agreement, all parties are to cease hostilities and disengage from any violence. Major General Ibrahim Abdul Jalil, chairperson of the ceasefire and transitional security arrangements, monitoring and verification mechanism, or CITISAM, the body monitoring implementation of the ceasefire, says there have been several violations of the ceasefire according to recent reports. Kandak resident Kwach Lotong has this message for President Kiir and Riek Machar.
The land or South Sudan is not for Salva Kiir and Dr. Riek, is for all the South Sudanese people. So they need to mind about the life of South Sudanese people who are gathering in Sudan or who are in other places. So they have suffered a lot because the wars which fought in South Sudan suffered the community. So I would like to convey them my message that let this peace not be broke and let all South Sudanese come back to the area.
2 weeks ago, the UN Undersecretary for Peacekeeping Operations, while visiting South Sudan, warned that insecurity remains rampant across the country. He called on South Sudan's leaders to implement the peace deal without delay. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A UN Security Council report implicates South Sudanese rebels and government forces of committing atrocities against children dating back to 2014. SIN Deng Bio reports a spokesman for the South Sudan People's Defense Force is questioning the timing and the accuracy of the report.
The Security Council report says it documented and verified 394 incidents involving 987 children who were killed or maimed that took place in the last 3 months of 2014 and first half of 2018. And while it puts the blame on rebel forces, including the SPLAIO ally to Riek Machar, Johnson Olonge's armed group, Protaban Dengai SPLAIO, and the South Sudan National Liberation Movement, it says the government was responsible for 79% of child casualties. Major General Lul Roy Kwong, spokesman for the South Sudan People's Defense Force, formerly known as the SPLA, questions the timing of the report.
The accusations that you have just cited, no new accusations, right? They are always leveled against the government forces or against the government of the Republic of South Sudan each time there is chances of the country stabilizing, restoring peace and stability. So these are accusations that are always hill-time to give an impression that the country is not anytime soon ready to revert to normalcy. So these are reports that are meant to discourage the people of South Sudan and the region, and to paint us in a very dark light and portray us as warmongers.
While the report blames the government for 776 casualties involving children, it blames the SSNPS for killing two boys and the killing of one boy by the National Fire Brigade. Riek Machar's armed opposition killed and maimed 33 children, according to the report, while the SSNLM is blamed for 11 and 6 deaths each attributed to Johnson Olonge's armed group and the SSDACF. Four boys were killed by the SSPPF, and 5 boys were killed by Protaban Dengai forces, according to the report. 658 children were victims of rape and other forms of sexual violence between October 2014 and June 2018. Most cases took place in Unity State, Central Equatoria, and Western Equatoria. In the last 3 months of 2014, there were 442 verified cases, and that number was down significantly in the first half of 2018, which saw 19 verified cases, according to the report. Virginia Gamba, the UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict, told the Security Council Monday that she is alarmed by reports of such violations. Rai described her remarks as a false alarm.
I totally do not concur with all the things she had said and all the alarm she sounded. It was an alarm that was unwarranted. It does not reflect the reality on the ground. The situation on the ground is stabilizing.
On Monday, there were reports of fresh fighting in Yei River State's county of Minyore Payam between the National Salvation Front and the SPLAIO. The county commissioner told this program there was an unknown number of civilian deaths and that hundreds are fleeing their homes to avoid violence. The fighting comes after the latest peace deal was signed last month between government and rebel forces. Ayen Dangbior, VOA News, Washington.
Still on matters to do with rebels, the South Sudan Liberation Movement has a new leader. Jacob Nyer Gatkwot says SSLM is ready to work with President Salva Kiir to end the conflict in South Sudan.
In 2013, we signed the peace agreement with the government of Salva Kiir. We went to Juba. We were in Juba until 2016. Some of our members, including General Fuljang now, they are in the SPLA army. Only some of us came out, left the government of Juba to rebel against the government. And our leader, Bafin, used to be our leader until yesterday. Our group made a decision that General Bafin is not any longer a leader that can lead our movement anymore. That's why they appointed me to be his replacement.
As I sit here interviewing you, I'm also worried at the same time that it appears rebellion has become one way of people finding their ways to get into the government. You rebel so that when there is a peace agreement signed, you're appointed a minister or you're given a big post in the military. Why do people rebel?
Sometimes people take it this way. According to what you are saying now, even during the peace negotiation when we used to go to Addis, most of the people, they raise up the same question that you are raising now, that people are rebelling because of the position. And to me, I cannot talk about others. Myself, if I don't get any position in the government, and what I'm fighting for is solved, there's no any way that I can claim that I need position because I was fighting for the position. No.
But what are you fighting for?
I'm not fighting for the position.
What are you fighting for? A peace agreement was signed recently. What are you fighting for?
Right now, I'm not fighting. I was the one who signed with the President Salva Kiir and the rest. If you look at the picture that took place in Khartoum, in Khartoum, August, I was there. I was the one who signed, not Bapi Mwintil who signed. We are just changing our leadership.
You are now the new leader of the movement, and Baping is no longer your leader.
Yes, he's no longer our leader.
Why?
Even yesterday when we made our decision.
Why this change?
The change came because the man is not able to lead the movement the way our members want. Because he does not produce anything for all these years. He does not listen to the members. He makes decisions by his own way that cannot take members any longer. General Baping must go.
Bring me up to speed. This South Sudan Liberation Movement, how big is this group?
I cannot tell you now the size of our army because during negotiation time, we used to tell anybody who has that question. But we stopped it because now we cannot tell our size of our army to anybody. Because now what we are talking about now, people will know it tomorrow and they will hear it.
No,
so
but you have signed peace. I know during war it is a secret. The size of your army is a secret during war. When you have signed peace, you are still hiding the number of your army?
Even now, it is still secret. There is no anything. Because now, since we signed this peace agreement, it doesn't mean that anybody can just say the size of his army in the air.
How would you react to South Sudanese who would say some of you even don't have anybody behind you? You're just claiming that you have an army. And when you ask what is the size of your army, you will say it is a military secret when you have nothing.
People will know. People will know with letter. Even now they know. They know that why. That's why we are in members of the peace agreement. If we don't have any members, we cannot be. Not anybody now in South Sudan is a member of peace agreement.
If you have soldiers behind you, you would be proud to tell me how many soldiers you have.
You know, even during the struggle, the SPLA struggle, I don't think that anybody can tell you. Inside, even the SPLA, when we were fighting the government of Sudan, you cannot tell your army number on the media.
During the negotiations, you were supposed to reveal the number of your soldiers so that they can be cantoned. Now you're telling me it's a secret.
Yes.
Are you going to make up these numbers?
No, I'm not going to make up the number. Even when we asked for the number, those who have the number, they know it and they know what. The way we mention the numbers of our forces, even not only our movement, all the parties, they tell they mention their army side, but not in public. You can say it in a secret room.
In a secret room, yes, that's what I'm talking about. If you can say it in a secret room during wartime, that's acceptable. But during peacetime, why would you hide the number of your soldiers?
Are we now in a secret room? Where are you now? I think you are far away from the secret room now. I cannot tell you.
That's Jacob Nyergatkwot, the new leader of the South Sudan Liberation Movement. He was speaking with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, earlier this week. That's our show for this Thursday. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thank you for being our guest.